This episode is brought to you by Taste Washington. With more than 235 wineries, 65 restaurants, and some of the nation's most talented chefs, Taste Washington is the ultimate taste test. Learn more at tastewashington.org.
I'm HRN's Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. This week, we're celebrating Valentine's Day. Whether it's your favorite day of the season or you avoid it like the plague, there's no debating, it's a big day for the world of food and hospitality.
Valentine's Day is what we refer to in the industry as a blackout day.
I don't feel that my manlyhood is threatened when I order a glass of rosé or, God forbid, a rosé champagne.
It's an old Jamaican drink from way back, and we just decided to bring it back into existence. A drink that the men, they believe it really does wonders.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history. And today, we are going to explore some recent history tied to some old history. And it's all about lamb. The Jameson Farm in western Pennsylvania is 210 acres of wonderful scenic farmland that produces about 3,000 lambs annually. And it's been claimed to be some of the best lamb in the country. But when Suki and John Jameson purchased the old farmhouse over 40 years ago, they had no idea that they would become game-changing farmers, let alone being named Conservation Farmers of the Year in 2017. As sheep farmers, they learned techniques that harked back to historic methods, which have roots in pre-industrial and European farming. And after many trials and tribulations, their lamb gained traction and was declared the best in the country by some of the top named chefs in the country. They have a customer list that reads like a who's who in the food world. And they've written down their experiences, stories, and recipes in a new book called Coyotes in the Pasture and Wolves at the Door. And they're here with me in the studio to talk all about those experiences. Welcome, both of you.
Great.
All right, thank listen, you were high school sweethearts or college sweethearts? Anyway, you go back a long time.
A long way, yes.
Right.
And both in the same school as English majors, and now you've produced the country's best lamb for over 40 years. What happened? Tell us your story.
Boy, oh boy. Suki wanted to start, the first farm we had was smaller than the one we have right now, but the guy wouldn't sell an old stone farmhouse to us unless we bought the 65 acres that were with it. And so we didn't know what to do with it, and Suki wanted to have a 4-H project for the kids. So that's really where it started.
It's a lot of work for a couple of kids. I don't know. So the story goes on that you got a couple hundred sheep. What did you start out with?
We started out with 14 total.
14. And this is back, what, in
1976? 76.
All right.
Yeah. We first learned about sheep. Yes.
So when you finally then, you know, got to the wheels, and we'll get back to the processes.
Right.
You went around and you tried to, you mentioned the 4-H fair, and you went around and tried to get people to taste your lamb because you knew it tasted a lot better. And what were their reactions?
Well, I was doing some catering, and we used some of the lamb meat in my catering, and people really liked it.
But I thought at first when nobody wanted to taste lamb because they were so used to the...
Well, the American, as far as the American palate, back then it was maybe 1 in 10 people would even eat lamb.
Yeah, it wasn't really a real popular meat.
It was always considered very high-end, expensive. They only ate the rack or the loin chop.
Mm-hmm. But prior to that, they were getting... I know when as a kid we didn't eat it because my mother had such a bad taste in her mouth from it. What they ate probably was mutton, probably old.
Well, it was lamb. It was older, and then the other situation going back to the production methods now versus how it was a very long time ago is that since World War II, basically. Lamb has been born in the western states and then sent back after the lambs are weaned off the mothers. They then go to feedlots in the Midwest, and they're fed a lot of corn. And the oil from the corn goes to the fat, and that's why people say lamb is greasy. So that's the way we've been doing in this country for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And people... it's a cloying taste, and people really don't like it. And so when we started raising on grass, just because we were interested in raising them on grass, then we had some chefs try it, and they liked it. And because that's how it's raised, really, in every other part of the country, of the world.
Of the world, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think of sheep herders and... By and large, it's more ethnic populations, you know, the Basque regions and the Eastern European regions.
Right.
I mean, there and Sardinia and
yes, yeah. Oh, you're right,
Sicily and yeah, all
yeah.
And go on.
Well, and so with us when we first started selling to French chefs, they they really wanted milk lamb. Or as the French say, agneau de lait, but I can't pronounce it very well.
You did very well.
Thank you. But anyway, when you think about it, the main reason for having sheep in Southern Europe is really for cheese, because real Roquefort is sheep's cheese. Pecorino Romano is sheep's cheese. And so they have to pull the lambs off to milk the ewes, the mothers. And so those chefs are used to using a lot of smaller lamb. Hmm. And so that was really, because we were raising them ourselves, that's where we first started dealing with some of the heavyweight guys.
Okay, well, now let's go back to the time that you bought that house. Your
right.
idea was to restore this really quaint stone
right.
farmhouse, right? What happened?
Well, that... The house didn't fall down around us, but it became obvious that was going to be a very expensive issue to try to do much. So we got much more interested in the farm. We had a guy farming it, and that's what started everything.
And you looked at all the tall grass and all the mowing that had to be done?
Yeah, it was better to have animals do it.
Okay, so you got those few...
We got those few sheep and got started with it.
And they ate the grass. What made you decide to raise sheep as lambs as meat and not go into the milking end of it, or, you know, solely wool or whatever?
At that time, milk sheep in America weren't really available.
Oh, they weren't available.
Back, oh. Really, not that many.
Yeah, the proper breeds were not available.
Because then. It would be a specific breed that would be applicable for
interesting.
Milking sheep.
Interesting.
Yes.
And then the ewes that you acquired to produce?
Were basically a meat breed.
Okay. Interesting to know. I can and see the extent of my farm
of
background.
Breeds. Yeah, they have the wool breeds and they have the meat breeds.
Yeah, interesting. So there you got the meat used to produce the
they
the
do
lambs.
Produce wool also, but it's not of a fine quality.
But it can be used, right?
It can be used, but it's not the high quality of what you would get from a wool sheep.
Hmm. Okay.
So those exotic blends of wool that you see in crafts and things like that are from exotic breeds of sheep.
Yeah, very finely
yes.
combed as well, I'm sure.
Right.
Well, as you're what do you call it? Your flock.
Yes.
Grew.
Flock is good.
Bird, gaggle. No, it's a flock.
Flock
right?
is right.
It grew. One thing that surprised me in reading, I have to say, your book is filled with such charming stories. As I was talking to Suki earlier. Charming, yeah. Sometimes painful.
Yes.
Where tears want to fall, but, you know, and humorous, but they are very charming stories because you get, one gets a real sense of the land where you're living and how, if anyone should think you want to go into this business or go into farming as a business, you might second
that,
think
exactly.
It.
Exactly, yes.
But one thing that struck me, you were talking about, you know, as you doubled and tripled and quadrupled your flock.
Right.
What about the ratio? Somebody had asked you that, I think, in one of your stories. What is the ratio of rams to use?
So the story, should I tell the story?
Sure.
I assume what she's setting me up for is one of my favorite stories in the book that everybody wants me to tell all the time is the story about Jean-Louis Paladin, who was our mentor, really, and was his claim to fame was that he was at the time the youngest French chef ever to get 2 Michelin stars. He was only 28, which
now,
is a huge deal.
For those of you listening who have no recollection of Jean-Louis, first of all, he was a wild man.
He was a wild man, thank you.
But
yes.
I absolutely adored him, and a wonderful chef.
Yes.
But also very generous, very generous person in many ways.
In many, many ways.
So, anyway, as an explanation, so go on.
Well, that's right, and he discovered us when we were doing a benefit for Children's Hospital in Pittsburgh. He was one of the chefs selected, but we hadn't met him yet. This was in May of 88, and I knew he was going to do this dinner in October. And so I sent him some information about our lamb, and he called me on Memorial Day of 88 and ordered lamb, and that's a whole other story. But the fall, which I will get back to, but in the following year, we were doing another benefit, the same benefit for Children's Hospital. And he came to the farm, and Suki cooked for him, and she was very nervous because she was cooking for the only 2-star Michelin chef in the country at that time, cooking
lunch. I would be nervous, too.
I was nervous.
So it was, and she had shanks, and they were absolutely wonderful. And but anyway, Jean-Louis had been wined and dined for 3 days in Pittsburgh, and as you said, he was very charming and a lot of fun and a wild man. And so he looked like he had been wined and dined for 3 days. And so we went down. He wanted to go down to the barn. All these PR ladies wanted to talk to Suki about how beautiful the farm was, or the house and the farmhouse and the farm. And I took him down to the barn, and he looked at the lambs and said how beautiful they were. And we were both crying about how wonderful both of us were. And anyway, we walk outside. We walk out of the barn. And he saw the ewes on the hill, and all the sheep on the hill, and he said, "How many sheep's on the hill?" And I said, "Oh, with everybody, about 700. And then he said, "How many mommies?" And I said, 400. And he said, "How many daddies?" And I counted what I'd taken out, and I said, 4. And he looked, and his eyes changed, and his whole bearing changed, and he just went, "Ooh la la." That was that. But usually it's one ram to about 50 to 100, but these were what we call clean-up rams. So they were, you know, just there to see who
Make
was
sure.
still interested. That's right.
that is a great story.
Thank you.
And he loved your lamb, and he was very helpful in spreading the word to his to the other. Well, at that time, what people have to understand, there was this, as you called it very accurately, sort of this mafia of
French
chefs. Yeah,
this is a French mafia.
I mean, the French, and because I worked with a French woman, and I got to know many of them because they all really stuck together.
They did stick together.
Yeah.
And he was, when you, I forget the word you used about Jean-Louis, but he was very very nice. Well, he asked me the night that I delivered the lamb, and he thought it was so beautiful, he started crying. And he said to me, he said, "How big do you want to get?" And he called up all his friends.
Wow.
And that's really what happened.
Wow, that'll grow the business quickly. It did. Yeah. Well, that was when we were, you know, we were on the cusp, we as being America, of this new food movement.
Yes.
Right. And he was there for the very beginning.
Absolutely.
Of that.
He was.
Absolutely.
Very instrumental.
Right. And as were many of the French chefs, and Danielle is still there.
Still going strong.
Right.
Yep.
Danielle Boulud.
Right.
All right. So that was, by then, your lamb was good. You knew it was good, and
right.
the chefs were discovering it was good. But you were doing something that was rather unusual. You just described earlier about the whole feedlot
right.
method of kind of mass production
yes.
of lamb, and you were taking a few steps back in history, we can say, but
yes.
in farming history, and you were embracing another technique. Tell me about how you had decided to raise and feed your flock.
Well, there were various factors involved. The land grant colleges like Penn State wanted everything grown on. They were worried about. They were concerned with how much it cost to feed them. The average cost per pound. But with no interest in what the animal tastes like. And so what happened was in 1974, we had the Arab oil embargo, and the Arab oil embargo pushed up grain prices in this country. So at that time, people, interestingly enough, in our part of the country before any other part of the country, started raising animals on grass to supplement the feed that they were buying on grain, trying to keep the average cost down, the inputs down. The reason it started in our part of the country is because we had high tensile fencing started from New Zealand, and then it came over to this country. And with high tensile fencing, we could subdivide fences so we could rotate the animals around. And the first steel company, and the biggest one, that makes high tensile smooth wire is U.S. Steel in Pittsburgh. And so it all started in Pittsburgh and Western
sense.
Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And so that we got very interested in that. At the same time, so the basic textbook to it is a book called Grass Productivity by André Voisin, and that was in the 50s. He wrote this, and this kind of production had been going on for hundreds of years, but he broke it down into a science, into a system. And so it was putting a lot of animals on a small area for a short period of time. And we had, when we started it, we would put about 250 ewes with their lambs on 2 acres for 2 days. And they would go in, and the grass would be 10 to 12 inches high. And after 2 days, it was 2 inches high. And by doing that, by eating the grass down, this is real quick, as she told me, I'm not allowed to go on with this. But anyway, it's a quickie, is that the animals go in, eat all the grass down. The grass, since it's now eaten down, exposes the white clover, which is the natural legume in our soil, above 6 pH acidity level.
Which is usually used like a ground cover, right?
So that's right.
It keeps low.
And, yeah,
low.
Exactly. And so because it's now exposed, because the animals have eaten it down, then, being a legume, it fixes nitrogen from the air and then grows more grass. So it's a system. So what you do, so they eat everything down. The legume is bringing nitrogen into the soil, and you take the animals off that for 20 to 40 days, let's say, depending on what time of the year it is. In April, May, in our area, it's only 20 days because the grass is growing so fast.
Right.
And so that's what we do. So they're all raised on grass on our farm. You see pictures in the book about how beautiful the grass is. We have never seeded anything, nothing, ever.
Wow.
That's really something.
Good soil, good grass, good treatment of the soil, right? Well, André Voisin was one of the names I had that I wanted to make sure you mentioned and talked about who
he
was.
Yeah.
The other one is Louis Bromfield. How was he, who is he, and how does that figure in your learning all these new techniques or learning how to farm?
You want me to start on Bromfield?
You talk about Bromfield.
So
Bromfield. He's from Ohio.
So we were both English majors in college. So Bromfield was one of the expats between the war in Paris, a friend of Alice B. Toklas and Hemingway and Fitzgerald. And so for English majors, how cool is that? And so anyway, he also hosted the marriage of Lauren Bacall and Humphrey Bogart at his house in Ohio. But
on his farm.
Malabar Farm. And what he did was, he was an expat in Paris during that time period of all that great writing. And in 38 or 39, he saw what was happening with the war, oncoming war, and he moved back to his home area of Mansfield, Ohio, and bought four or five old worn-out farms and restored them. And he funded that by being a screenwriter in Hollywood. That's how he knew Bogart. They became good friends. But he did a lot. After he moved back to Ohio, he really concentrated on the farms and wrote a lot about them and had farming methods that were, we probably wouldn't say organic, but certainly sustainable. And he used grass a lot to restore the pastures. Well, really to restore the whole farm. Before, he would break soil, but he always kept it in grass and hay for 4 or 5 years before he did that.
Hmm. Well, there's so much to learn and enjoy about the stories, but we're going to come back and talk about some of those, as well as the food that is prepared in the kitchens at the farm, and right after a short break, so stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by New York Mutual Trading, the premier Japanese food, alcoholic beverage, and restaurant supply specialist. Mutual Trading is the Japanese food authority, true to the heart in upholding genuine Japanese food traditions and progressive in exploring new ways to provide innovative restaurant supplies and services. They import, export, distribute, and manufacture the top brands for retailer and food service customers nationwide. Learn more at nymtc.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Andrew Friedman, and I'm the host of Andrew Talks to Chefs here on HRN. Every week, I interview a diverse cross-section of the best and biggest names in professional cooking. Give a listen and get to know all about the inner lives of chefs. You can find Andrew Talks to Chefs wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
On a trade with the French.
What? No, true.
Hi, we're back, and I am speaking with John Jameson and Suki Jameson of Jameson Farms, one of the premier lamb producers in America. And we were talking about the wonderful grasses and how, you know, you got to do it right to be able to keep that grass growing. Otherwise, you end up with dirt lots, right?
Right. Yep.
But then there's another factor in all that that maybe is a word that, of course, is bandied about quite a bit these days in foods. We heard it in wines forever, and that's terroir and tasting the terroir in different foods. And talk about the lamb production, how this enters into it.
Well, I in Southwest Pennsylvania in the 1900. The largest merino, that's where the largest merino flocks in the country were.
Mm. And now we're talking wool, right?
Now we're talking wool, but we're still talking about sheep production, and we're talking about the fact that the grass was so good, is so good in that area, that this is pre feedlots. And so that's how they were raised. And it was the it's the best grass in the country. And there's four or five counties. There's Greene County, Westmoreland County, Washington County, Armstrong County, and in the old days, Allegheny, which where Pittsburgh is, but it when it was a when it was still somewhat agrarian. So the grass production has been there. When we started selling to Jean-Louis specifically, I asked him what the best lamb in France was, where it was from. And he told me Pauillac in the Bordeaux area. And then I asked him, I have to say this first, I asked him about the Pré Salé in Normandy, and he went, no, 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 no. And I said, pourquoi? And he said, this is fine if you want the lamb that tastes like the fish, which I was, that's a great line. But anyway, he his favorite lamb was one called Sisteron, and it's in the lower Alps, and the elevation is 1,425 feet. Hmm. The elevation at our farm is 1,250. So it's very, very similar, and the grasses are similar. And so in the spring, we will have a taste of onion and garlic, naturally. Those are the grasses we have. And then as the summer goes on, we'll have anise and other herbs, and then wild carrot. And all these tastes are in there. And it is definitely a terroir that is there only in that area. We had a luncheon this summer with a whole bunch of fancy wine people, and there was a lady beside me who had was having a rack of lamb, and she tasted the rib chop, and she asked me, what is this seasoned with? And I said, salt and pepper. And she said, no, there's something else. And I tasted it. And I said, that's the grass. That's what you aren't used to that. And that's what it is. And
so when was that lamb slaughtered? So was that a spring lamb?
That would have been in June.
So it would have been a spring
lamb. Yeah, muscatel. Right. Yeah, it was.
So there she was tasting garlic and whatever grasses
and
come
then
up
everything
right
was
early.
Coming
right.
Up. It's just what was there.
So the seasonality really has an effect.
It does. Right? It has a huge effect. And people that get feedlot lamb, you don't have that. Mm-hmm. It's the same. It's very. It's like many things American. It's very. It's
consistent.
The same.
Consistent. It's always
but
consistent,
boring.
But boring.
Consistent but boring. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it depends how you look at it, right?
Yes.
Well, and I was so surprised when you were talking about the Queen Anne's lace, which, you know, you look at the leaf, the early little, the little small leaves of the Queen Anne's lace, and you see, well, gee, is that a carrot coming up in my
that's
field,
what
or
it is
it Queen Anne's? It's a type of carrot, right?
Yes, it is. It's wild carrot.
So if you see those fields of Queen Anne's lace, and then imagine sheep grazing in there, they're going to taste like a sweet carrot. That's I think that's wonderful. I think it's such a wonderful thing to think about when one is is purchasing or thinking about eating meat. And if you eat meat, you have to know where it comes from.
That's true.
And also how it's treated. Now, you've gotten into a certified humane program, right? And Sugi, I was asking you how many employees you have to after all these years, and you said on the farm it's just you, the couple of you and a lot of yous. No, you and the sheep. But
yes,
then you bought a slaughterhouse and a processing plant, right?
Right.
In 1994, we purchased our own slaughterhouse, which is every girl's dream, you can imagine.
Yeah. and there you you have major control of how everything's finishing.
Right.
I mean, you've done
right.
all this hard work and paid all this attention onto how the sheep are fed. So, and the lambs are
it's a very important factor in the whole process of presenting a beautiful product. You can have the most beautiful product in the world, but if you don't have control over the slaughter of it, or the cutting, or the presentation, how do you
and the
know?
Hanging and the
There's
aging,
no guarantee
all those things.
That what you put in there is going to come back to be what you want, but we have that control.
Well, you, and of course you working with the product in the kitchens and cooking, and there are wonderful recipes in there that I adore. You have a lot of, unbeknownst to you, I think at the time, historic recipes, or at least takes on historic recipes, right?
That, after years and years of practice.
Yeah.
We didn't have to have recipe testers. They're all tested.
Yeah. But then, you know firsthand whether the product is, you know, is good or not as you're cooking this. But
right. Plus, we make our own products at the plant. So I've been cooking those particular recipes, the prepared products, for years. You have one set recipe, you don't touch it.
Something's off, it's got to be.
So, you know, when you get the barley soup, it's the same today as it was 10 years ago, and it will be 10 years from now.
And it's really, I'll throw this back to Suki, but she was the one that really forced us to buy the plant because we dealt with three or four other processors that would not cut things the way she wanted them cut, wouldn't age them the way we cut. And then in this way, when you were talking about the humane issue, we have total control over it. And my guys have been with me for enough years where the when we have people come in to inspect, as we used to in the old days, and now the USDA does, for any sort of humane issues, the animals don't even know anybody's there because we all know how to handle them. I mean, it's just great that
interesting
way. Yeah.
Well, we have to throw out a couple of more famous names because you, as I say, were, you've got a who's who list of contacts and customers. But somebody whose help you enlisted or whose opinions you enlisted was Julia Child.
Yes.
And there's a terrific story about how she reduced you, Suki, to tears, but yeah, with her proclamation of the lamb was tough. But that was a real revelation to you. What? Tell me about one of you. You know, talk about that story.
That was when we saw her at a convention.
Yeah,
IACP.
We were at the IACP, and it was in spring of 1996, and it was about 2 weeks after Easter, and we just sent her a leg of lamb. The first time we had sent her a leg of lamb from this new plant we bought. And Suki went up to her and said, Julia, how did you like the leg of lamb? And she said, well, dear, it was very tasty but rather tough.
And she was a real fan of yours from the beginning.
Oh, yes,
right?
Always.
Absolutely.
But she also never minced words.
Right.
And was would tell one exactly what she thought that person should be told, politely, but made the point. And so we went to the meat lab at State College and Penn State and started saying we had this problem with the lamb being tough. And the reason was that because they're grass-fed lambs and they don't have a lot of cover over the back.
A lot of fat.
A lot of fat, exact, thank you, is that when you, after they're slaughtered and the temperature is about 100 degrees, if you put them into a cooler at 35 degrees, which in today's world people do, because there's not a lot of insulation over the back, the animals will come down in temperature, the carcass will come down in temperature too quickly. And it causes a condition called cold shortening, where the muscles contract. So in explaining it to a chef, it's the same thing that a chef does when he takes the meat out of the fridge and lets it go to room temperature before he cooks it. It's kind of the same
reverse
thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so they chill down very slowly, and they're tender and they're great. And she was the other thing about it, and really is the reason we became such good friends, is after that happened and we sent her lamb afterwards, and she never endorsed anything, but she wrote us a letter saying it was the best lamb she ever had, and that's fine. Makes me very happy. But we became her go-to person for any of these issues. And that was neat because we knew more than she did about mm-hmm. one thing. Mm-hmm. And she was such a student of food that she always said she learned every day. And she really was a person who felt that way,
I think. Absolutely. Yeah. And Suki, you... I so we don't run out of time here, because the important part, I think, of the business, well, you have to have the good lamb, right? The excellent lamb. But I'm amazed that for so many years you have been producing the dish, you know, dishes, prepared foods that are sold on, you sell them through your website?
Right, right. What happened, well, it really came out of necessity, because in the early days of our business, we were selling, selling the rack and the saddle, the middle meats, because that was popular. And there was the rest of the animal. And we talked to Jean-Louis about this very problem, because he would order, you know, six lamb backs, which is racks and saddles of six lambs. What do I do with the rest of the lamb? I didn't have, nobody else wanted the rest of the lamb. So we came up with ideas, and he told us, I was making one stew, and he came to me, and we worked on a stew recipe, and so I created a stew with him.
Interesting. And I mean, now you don't have to do it necessarily, but it's just, I'm sure people clamor after these dishes.
I still make all those products. I have a lamb pie, which is a pot pie, and two stews, and a lamb barley soup. And also
we have three different sausages.
Mm.
Great merguez.
All pieces of the lamb are in use.
Well, when you, the recipes, you had me at the slow cooked shoulder. I mean, you know, that's.
Oh, it's wonderful.
I read that recipe and went, okay, there I am. Yeah. But the recipes are all very, very, I don't want to say simple. They're not simple, but easy.
They are simple.
They're very approachable, but obviously you're working with such a good product, it doesn't need a lot of help and pushing along the way. So,
and you don't want to disguise the flavor either.
Right.
You want the flavor to come through. And so I think that's another thing from Jean-Louis, is it's all about the ingredients. And so you don't want to mask it with all kinds of flavors of things that don't go. You don't need that.
So when you want to have that meat-forward dinner, then make it, then do it. Don't, as you say, don't push it to the back.
We always say there's nothing in these recipes that you can't understand. Most of the ingredients you have right on hand.
Oh, well, one thing we did talk about before we went on the air, and I want to mention it again, is this all comes at a cost. And, of course, that cost has to be met in your sales, or else you would be out of business.
Right.
Is there much resistance in the market to the cost of your product?
I don't think as much now as in the past. I think that in the last 20 or 30 years, with more interest in farm to table, more interest in the food channel and everything, just people are thinking more about where good food comes from.
Right.
And people are becoming what my one friend calls a flexitarian, mm-hmm. where they'll eat meat as long as they know where the meat comes from, and they're willing to pay for it. If it's so, that way I think it's better. But yes, it's never been a lucrative business, but it's cool, you know, is kind of the way you have to look at it. I mean, and we've had a wonderful time meeting so many wonderful people, and really, and this is really why I wrote the book, I think, is that it was at the start of this change of thinking so seriously now about food and where it comes from.
And if you want good food, you have to pay for it.
You have to pay for it.
And I think, unfortunately, a lot of this country, we got in sort of a mode of supermarket mentality, and it's like, oh, I can get this much cheaper here. Yeah, you will, but what are you getting? You know, what are you eating? And, you know, so treat yourself once in a while and have, you know, a very good product. Eat vegetables the other time, but
that's right.
Have a very good product. And Suki, I mentioned some that you sort of unbeknownst to you initially, but by the by, you ended up making some historic recipes. I'm thinking particularly the lamb paprikash.
Right. Yeah. When we did research about that.
Yeah.
I mean,
I'm thinking of, you know, Eastern European relatives and how we always had paprika. And lamb centers in so many of those stews and dishes. Really. It's just a wonderful product. And
people don't understand that you can substitute lamb for a lot of recipes that they have. Most of my recipes could have been made with beef, I suppose.
And I'm sure many of the
in America they would be
typical
made in
American
beef.
Cookbooks had them as
exactly.
Well, shepherd's pie was you know that,
yeah, that's what drives me crazy.
And shepherd's pie, yeah, you know, you think of what did you eat? It was sort of a clean out the refrigerator dish in my family.
Right.
exactly. anything under the mashed potatoes.
Right. But it was who's a shepherd? You mentioned who's a shepherd? And they raised lamb and
that's what they ate. And really when I was researching goulash, mm-hmm. It was kind of the same thing, so it's similar. And when we did the lamb paprikash at the Pennsylvania Farm Show, this was 2 years ago. We did it as the main dish. We're asked to go on stage and do something, and there were so many because Pennsylvania, being Pennsylvania, we have a large population of Eastern Europeans. And all these young people came in and said, "This is like my grandmother's. I got to take it to her." And it was because they all had that when they were young, and they loved it. It's great.
Interesting. Well, there are just so many wonderful stories, so much history there. For you, I mean, in your own personal history, it is, you know, did you ever think when you were kids, falling in love back in college, that you were going to end up you are today.
No.
Yeah. It's amazing the paths that we take and where we end up. But
we've met the most fascinating people over the years. We've been really lucky that way.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Wonderful.
I'm sure that you have. And you had to work at other jobs along the time, and you raised three kids along with doing all this too. But you end up, this is your full-time occupation.
This is it.
Been our full-time life.
Your full-time life. Yeah. Right. Come home from work and work the farm.
Yeah. That's right.
Well, and as one very sage farmer told me one time, saying, "Well, maybe on your day off you could come over and help me do." And he goes, "If you have live animals, there are no days
off.
There
are no days off. That's true.
Right. That's right.
And you included in your book some very poignant tales about that. And and it's a, you know, it's a tough business, and hence the name Coyotes in the Pasture and Wolves at the Door. And that's the name of the book that all your stories are contained
We've had that name for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Filled in the
just
stories.
Waiting to fill it in, right?
Exactly.
Yes.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, I urge anyone who has ever been tempted by the idea of owning one of those romantic farms, we'll have a few sheep, read this story. It's wonderful. Coyotes in the Pasture and Wolves at the Door. And along with it, you get wonderful recipes. I mean, every little section is separated by another great recipe. And it's John and Suki Jameson, and it's jamesonfarm.com. There's a wonderful short video that I think Stone Barnes, Dan Barber, and Stone Barnes do for you. In anything that we haven't covered, it just shows John in the pasture with lambs, with the sheep.
And a dog.
A dog, and so many great stories about the dog, but it really describes what raising sheep in the meadows can do.
Yeah,
and I urge people to take a look at that at jameson.com.
Thank
you.
And
don't forget Coyotes in the Pasture and Wolves. We won't go into the wolves at the door.
No.
Let them find out. But that's called life. You know.
Yes, it is. Yes.
Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you for having us. This is great.
It's been a pleasure. And
really appreciate
you for listening. And be sure to tune in again and join us for another great Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. and we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.